Hello, it's Tuesday, March 7th, and you're listening to Wing Radio. I'm Lisa Giuliani.
And I'm Victor Thorne. Welcome to Wing Radio, which can be found at www.wingtv.net. Before we bring our guest on today, Lisa has a quick announcement to make that we think is very, very important.
Now, you all know that we don't really think much of petitions, and in the past, petitions really haven't accomplished very much, if anything at all, but there is one now that we urge you to sign. We urge you not to ignore it and send it around to everyone you know. It's the petition to Congress at scholarsfor911truth.org, and they are looking for 10,000 signatures. I've signed it. Victor signed it. A lot of 9/11 researchers have signed it. You don't have to leave your name. You can do it anonymously. We urge you to sign this petition. They're calling for release of documents, film, physical evidence, etc. from 9/11. We're trying desperately to get it. Please go to scholarsfor911truth.org.
And as Vinny Sammartino, a 9/11 researcher, says, sign it like John Hancock signed it in capital letters. That's what we did. So be loud, be proud about it. And this is one of the few times we'll ever endorse something like this. So take a look at it. Now, our guest today is Mr. Jerry E. Smith. And he's the author of a book called HARP, Ultimate Weapon of the Conspiracy. He was also the editor of Dharma Combat, who he worked with Mr. Jim Keith, who we thought was one of the best writers and researchers ever.
Yes.
And he also just released a book within the last month or two called Secrets of the Holy Lance, The Spear of Destiny in History and Legend. We'd like to introduce Mr. Jerry E. Smith to Wing TV. How are you doing, Jerry?
Hi, Jerry.
Hi, I'm doing good. Good to be with you.
Well, thanks for coming on today. Before we get started, tell everybody how they can find this book. What's your website address? And, we think it's something everyone should definitely take a look at.
Well, I co-authored this book with George Picard, who wrote Liquid Conspiracy, JFK, LSD, the CIA, Area 51, and UFOs. George put up a website for our book, and it has a real easy-to-remember spearbook.com, spearbook.com, spearbook.com. You don't even need the darn W's. And you can get a copy of the book autographed by both of us at that site. You can also get it from my personal website, which is jerryesmith.com, jerryesmith.com. You can also get it from our publisher, which is Adventures Unlimited Press at adventuresunlimitedpress.com. And we are distributed by the nation's largest book distributors. You can get it in virtually every bookstore in the country, particularly Barnes & Noble, Borders, etc. You can get it online at barnesandnoble.com, amazon.com. Of course, there you can get it for a discount, but you can't get it autographed.
All right. Very good.
Jerry, I guess we need to begin this interview asking you about the subject of relics and the significance they hold and the powers they're said to possess.
Well, virtually every religion on this planet believes in the power of relics and the power of the supernatural. The Buddhism, Hinduism, Christianity, Judaism, Islam all believe that there is the greater reality, that is the reality of God, of the spirits, the saints, and so forth. And then there is the physical realm we live in, and that there's a bleed through from the supernatural into the natural. And one of the points of bleed-through are these relics. These are objects that are either portions of saints or prophets, like their bones, hanks of hair, and so forth, mm-hmm. or things that were intimately associated with them, such as their clothes or sandals or such. And it's believed that virtually every religion stores these things and displays these things, and both as a memento of what these people did, but also in hopes that some of that supernatural power that helped them to become saints and prophets will come through to the person who was visiting the shrine.
Right. Now, Jerry, I first became aware of the Spear of Destiny through a book by Trevor Ravenscroft, which is
right.
Very...
Right. That was a hugely popular book in the early 70s called The Spear of Destiny.
Uh-huh.
And that book is very New Age. Ravenscroft was an initiate into the occult, and the book deals largely with initiation into the occult, and with particularly with Adolf Hitler and the the Nazi use of the black side of the you know the
right.
Well, the I think dark side of the force.
Well, what we should start off then is what precisely is the Spear of Longinus, and also how does your book move beyond that of Trevor Ravenscroft?
Well, the story as told in the Gospel of John in the New Testament was that as Jesus hung on the cross, there were sentries sent to break the limbs of him, the legs of him, and the thieves crucified with him,
uh-huh.
so as to hasten their death, so that they would be dead before the Sabbath, because it was against the Jewish law for them to be hanging on the tree after sunset. And as the sentries came up to break Jesus' legs, there was another centurion there who saw that Jesus had already died and pierced his body with his spear to show them that they didn't have to do the ignominy of breaking his bones. And in doing so, the Christian legend has it that blood and water came out of the wound, splashed into the centurion's eyes, curing him of cataracts, at which point that was the first miracle of the spear. And a legend has arisen that whoever possesses this spear and understands the powers it serves holds in his hand the destiny of the world for good or evil.
Okay.
Okay, now this is also called the Holy Lance, right?
The Holy Lance, the Spear of Destiny, the Spear of Longinus, the Spear of Christ.
Okay.
Got a handful of names.
Many famous people and groups have possessed this Holy Lance, including the Templar Knights, Napoleon, Charlemagne, Hitler. Why is this such... why have people wanted to possess this so much, and what powers is it said to have, and what evidence exists to confirm that or refute that?
Well, Napoleon didn't get it. He tried, and the way that spear ended up in Vienna is they were hiding it from him.
Uh-huh.
But among the things that the spear is said to do is it's said to give one invincibility. And Hitler claimed it after the Anschluss, the annexation of Austria in 1938, and kept it on his person for the next 8 months, and that was the period of the Blitzkrieg. That was when he was invincible and rolled across Europe.
Uh-huh.
Other people who have had it and been invincible include such people as Constantine the Great and Charlemagne. Charlemagne maintained that it gave him what in today's lexicon would be a precognition, that he saw battles before they happened, and with it, he fought and won 49 out of 49 battles because it showed him how to win them.
Very interesting.
The most famous metaphysical event around the spear was Constantine's vision. Most Christians are familiar with how Constantine was converted to Christianity by... With the Spear of Destiny in his possession, he saw a vision in the sky and had what today would be called clairaudience and clairvoyance.
Mm-hmm.
He saw the vision and heard the phrase, "With this sign you will conquer." He then put the sign on his soldiers' shields and went on to become the emperor.
Yeah. Well, Jerry, when this book first came out, I read it, was it a couple months it's been out now?
It came out in July of last year.
Okay, well, I guess I read it a couple months ago. And I want to ask you throughout the interview a couple questions just from the book. One of the things I found most interesting was your section about Adolf Hitler and the possibility of a fake suicide. Touch upon that for a couple minutes.
I actually have been studying that since the end of the 80s. And George Picard, who wrote a book about the aftermath of Operation Paperclip, has also been studying it since the early 90s. And we both conclude, as did President Eisenhower, as did Joseph Stalin, that Hitler did not die in the bunker. Immediately after the war, opinion polls showed that around 85% of Americans did not believe that he died in the bunker.
Huh.
And for the next couple of decades, there were Hitler sightings that were as common as Elvis sightings would be a couple of decades later.
Uh-huh.
I guess there's is more than one lance. Which one is the real one, and has it been scientifically tested?
There are indeed several lances based on the story of where Longinus went after the crucifixion. One story says that he stayed in the Holy Land, becoming a Christian, proselytizing there, got in trouble with the local authorities, and was executed as a bad person by being a Christian, and that his spear stayed there and ended up in the Vatican. That's the one that the Knights Templars had.
Mm-hmm.
Then there is another story that he went east following Paul into Turkey and Armenia, and there's a little church in Armenia that has an object they claim is it. This object was found by a crusader in the 1400s. The trouble is the one in this church in Armenia apparently is not a spear at all, but is actually a standard head, a flagpole top. It just looks like a spear. And then there's the one in the then there's the one in the museum in Austria. And this one seems to be the one that we can track its chain of custody back about to Charlemagne, who had himself proclaimed the first emperor of the Holy Roman Empire with it on Christmas Day, the year 800 AD.
So where's the Vienna one now?
Now the one in Vienna was tested by Dr. Robert Feather, a British metallurgist, in 2003, and Feather's team concluded that it was probably made in the 6th or 7th century. Far enough, it's old, but not anywhere near old enough to have been the one used by Longinus at the crucifixion.
However,
attached to it is a nail that was added about the year 1200 by one of the emperors of the Holy Roman Empire that is claimed to be a nail from Jesus' cross.
Mm-hmm.
And that nail is consistent with a first century Roman nail or pin, so if that's possible.
Okay. Well, Jerry, as World War II was winding down, U.S. forces were moving into Berlin, General Patton was one of the few people that actually realized the relevance of this spear. Tell us a little bit about him and how he knew what the secret of the Holy Lance was.
Patton is a very interesting fellow. He very much believed in past lives. He very much believed that he had lived many past lives. There's a great scene in the movie where he and his driver come over a hill and see to the driver, it's just a valley, but to Patton, he can see a battle between the Romans and the Carthaginians, and describes the battle in detail because he was there. Patton wrote a lengthy poem called "Through a Glass Darkly," describing many of his past lives, and in it, he describes himself as being Longinus holding the Holy Spear. As the war was winding down, Patton became convinced it would be important to get a hold of this thing, and he grabbed an art historian and put him on a quest to find it. Now, in Trevor Ravenscroft's book, Ravenscroft gets virtually everything about this story wrong. How he succeeded in bungling it so thoroughly is a mystery to us. But we actually interviewed family members of this guy. He was a art historian at University of California, Berkeley, for a number of years after the war. He did find it eventually. The U.S. Army actually took possession of it and had it for a couple of months before they knew what they had.
Uh-huh.
Horn, the art historian, did locate it, and almost as soon as he told Patton, "Okay, I've got it," Eisenhower said, "Okay, give it back to the Austrians." So Patton never did get his hands on it.
Hmm.
I know you wanted to talk about the spear making its way to Antarctica and back, and also please address where it is now. Who controls it now?
That is one of the wildest aspects of the spear tale. In the middle of the 1980s, medical college professor, a medical doctor, Dr. Howard Buechner, who taught medicine at Tulane and then LSU, was approached by a man who said he had been a submariner with the German submarine fleet, and that he had helped move senior Nazis and Nazi treasure out of Germany in the last days of the war, and this Nazi treasure included the Spear of Destiny, where they took it to Antarctica, and then his submarine surrendered at Mar del Plata, Argentina, a few months after the war's end. There were, in fact, two submarines that did, indeed, surrender months after the war's end under very suspicious circumstances at Mar del Plata. This soldier, this sailor, further claimed that in 1979 he was approached by the guy who was in charge of sending all this stuff to Antarctica and asked to help round it up again. And that this group of German businessmen calling themselves the Knights of the Holy Lands went to Antarctica in 1979 and dug up the Nazi treasure, Hitler's personal memorabilia, and the Spear of Destiny and brought it back. And again, where it is now is a serious piece of conjecture. We kind of think, we lean towards believing that Buchner was the victim of an incredibly elaborate hoax, but there's enough facts in the piece to make one think it may in fact be true. One of the aspects of it is that in Buchner's books, Buchner wrote two books in 1988-89, and he said that the way this happened was that during the war, Heinrich Himmler, who was absolutely fascinated but overwhelmed with this Spear of Destiny, found an old castle, turned it into a spear castle, in which every room in the castle was appointed with stuff owned by previous possessors of the Holy Lands. And he created a circle of Teutonic knights to engage in black magic rituals with the Holy Lands. And Hitler, after keeping it for 8 months, passed it to Himmler for use in this crazy castle doing weird black magic.
That's really interesting.
The story officially is that it went on display in Nuremberg, but according to Buchner's source, a Japanese sword maker made an exact replica of it. The replica stayed in the crazy castle to do black magic, while the replica went to Nuremberg, went on display, and from there was found by Patton's people and then given back to the Austrians.
You mean the real one?
Yeah.
Right. The real one stayed in the crazy castle and then went on the submarine to Antarctica, while the replica went on display and then back to Vienna.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and anyone that wants to read more about this, we won't ruin the story, but there's also a very fascinating part about Station 211 in Antarctica. But I want to ask you right now, Jerry, about something else you touch on in this book, Operation Paperclip, and three individuals, James Angleton, who Michael Collins Piper said was instrumental in the JFK assassination, also Henry Kissinger and Reinhard Gehlen. Tell us how they were involved in Operation Paperclip and bringing these Nazi scientists into the United States.
At the end of the war, both the all of the Allies, the USSR, the USA, the UK, went racing into Nazi Germany and grabbed all the scientists and intellectuals that they could get their hands on. And the US came away with two major stashes. They got the Peter Mundy rocket group under Wernher von Braun, and they got the German East of Berlin Intelligence Network under Reinhard Gehlen, where Wernher von Braun went on to give us NASA, and Reinhard Gehlen went on to give us CIA.
Uh-huh.
And most Americans have heard about Wernher von Braun and know that we brought some Nazi scientists over. They have no clue how many. It was at least 7,000 Nazi scientists and spy masters and their families. The total number brought over is somewhere between 12 and 18,000 people.
That's incredible.
Who went to the U.S., went to Canada, went to Mexico, and other friendly powers.
Mm-hmm. Jerry, we hold the work of Jim Keith to be very important, and we were just looking at a picture of you and Jim Keith before the show began, and you worked with him and knew the man. Tell everybody about Jim Keith.
Jim Keith was very, very large. in practically every sense. He was an incredible fun fellow to drink with, an incredible fun fellow to party with. He was a brilliant mind, incredibly smart, walking multiple stacks of encyclopedias. He could remember names, facts, dates like nobody I knew. I knew him from high school to his untimely death. He and I worked together on projects throughout that time period. I started off doing little fan magazines under Jim's direction.
Yeah, and I cut my teeth on him years ago, and he's one of the big ones out there that if people haven't read, definitely should. So, Jerry, before we get into the last question, one more time, give out your own personal website and also the one where people can find Secrets of the Holy Lambs.
Okay. We have a website for the book, which is spearbook.com, spearbook.com. You can get autographed copies, autographed by both authors, George Picard and myself. At that website, you can also get it from my website, jerryesmith.com. You can also get it online from directly from the publisher at adventuresunlimitedpress.com. You can call 1-800-718-4514. Right this moment, there are people standing by, 1-800-718-4514. That's Adventures Unlimited Press. Or you could buy it online at BarnesandNoble.com, Amazon.com, or in virtually any major bookstore. And if they don't have it in stock, they can usually get it within 3 days.
And I also urge everybody to check out Jerry's other books, especially his book on harp.
Right, yeah. Now, Jerry, the last question. We brought up Adolf Hitler a little bit earlier. And I know Trevor Ravenscroft got into a lot of the occult influences on the Nazi Party and the SS. Tell us about an individual named Dietrich Eckart that seems to be at the core of all this occult knowledge and occult wisdom that he passed along.
Okay, I can tell you a little bit, but let me say, George wrote the Nazi sections of the book.
Okay.
I wrote the ancient history and the Antarctic sections of the book. So I'm a little vague on exactly what Eckart was about. What I know is that there was the New Age, as we know it today, really started in Central Europe at the end of the 1800s. And by the very early 1900s, there was substantial New Age movement, which split into three major areas. There was the occult, which went towards black magic. There was the spiritual movement, which went towards white magic. And there was a neo-pagan movement. And the Nazi inner core is largely lifted out of the black magic occult and the neo-pagan movement. And Eckart was one of the great black magicians of the first half of the 20th century.
And how much of an influence do you think this had on not only Hitler's mind, but the SS and the Nazi party at large?
You know, the mainstream historians are split down the middle on this one. The really tight-fingered ones say, you know, there was no occult. It was just a political movement. These were just political guys, and all the occult stuff is just nonsense.
Uh-huh.
And I think they're whistling in the dark, to tell you the truth. A very large minority of mainstream historians agree that there was a substantial occult faction within the Nazi inner core, and from what I can see, from my point of view, the political was an external trapping that they were using the politics to maneuver to create their new worldview, and their new worldview was a neo-pagan occult worldview.
You know what? I agree completely with your assessment. And Jerry, it's fascinating. It really is. I enjoyed the book thoroughly when I read it. And we urge everyone to go out, take a look at this. Jerry E. Smith, the book is called Secrets of the Holy Lance. And Jerry, thank you for coming on Wave TV
really
today.
We really loved listening to this. This is fascinating.
All right. Well, thanks for having me.
All right. Have a good day. Everybody, we'll be back tomorrow on Wing TV. And we'll dive right back into it again.
Again, we urge you to go to scholarsfor911truth.org, sign the petition, and we'll see you tomorrow.
Until tomorrow, keep your eyes open because there's a lot going on.